Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we want to hear from you about who your favorite fictional female characters are and who writes the best women characters. First, the FBI's Deputy Director Andrew McCabe was fired on Friday by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. According to an Inspector General report from the Justice Department, McCabe leaked information to the media about ongoing FBI investigations and, quote, lacked candor, end quote, on multiple occasions. McCabe says he was within his authority to disclose that information. The firing came just 2 days before McCabe was to retire on his 50th birthday and begin collecting full retirement benefits. So as it stands, McCabe could lose out on hundreds of thousands of dollars unless he works two more days in a federal agency. Enter Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan. He announced over the weekend that he has a job opening on his staff, and if McCabe wants it, he can have it. I talked to Congressman Pocan earlier today. He's a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes the Madison area. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, before we get to your job offer to Andrew McCabe, what was your reaction when you heard he had actually been fired just a couple days short of his retirement?
You know, I think my first reaction was one just so disappointed that this president seems to have a character flaw and just is missing human decency. You know, I know he's doing everything he can to try to subvert the Mueller investigation, and, you know, this is just one more of those steps. But to intentionally do something 26 hours before someone was supposed to retire, it's just not something you expect in a president, and I can't think of a previous president we've had that's been so ill-equipped at interacting with other humans. So, you know, my first reaction was, you know, this is a guy trying to send a message that anyone who challenges him, not only will he fire you, but he will destroy you. He'll attack your family. He'll go after your retirement. And I just found it so opposite of how, you know, we are here in Wisconsin. And it really upset me in that sense.
The justification for the firing was that McCabe had inappropriately had FBI members contact the media and then wasn't forthright about that when asked about it. What do you think of those justifications?
Well, you know, whether it be the fake New News memo that, you know, they got and reported to the White House, or the fake House Republican Intelligence Committee report saying the investigation was over. I mean, I'm used to seeing them use all sorts of wide justifications for doing things, but the bottom line is they all go towards the same goal, which is to derail the investigation. So if you've got someone who's about to be a major witness with memos documenting conversations during this crucial time, right now the president's trying to discredit him and trying to send a very vile signal that he will destroy anyone who goes and tells the truth during the investigation. So, you know, I know that's what they said, and we haven't been able to see the Inspector General's report yet, but every other report that they've shown us that said it did something, we found it to be, you know, completely false, and I would expect this one is as well.
Now, you tweeted initially and then restated your job offer to Andrew McCabe. What are you offering him?
Well, you know, originally we just tweeted out, you know, call me Andrew, and we had a little kind of a snarky comment about what the president did. But the bottom line is then later we said, no, this is a legitimate offer. You know, I don't think anyone should who served in law enforcement for all those years have to, you know, miss out on retirement because of the president's petulant man-child nature in this case. And we, you know, do a lot of work around election integrity. I have several bills in Congress around that. Very nonpartisan of nature. You know, we'd love to have him work on that for as much time as we need to, but also to make sure that someone who's served the public for that long gets the retirement due, and that Donald Trump can't, you know, continue to threaten people like he does.
Is this job offer just a political stunt?
No, because it's a legitimate offer. We will hire him, have him come in. The bottom line is, if the president's going to use this to try to intimidate witnesses, he can't do that. He has to learn that he is not a dictator. He is not Vladimir Putin, despite how much he would love to be him, that there are checks and balances in the system. And in this case, we just did a check. And, you know, again, I think this is important. And I can't tell you how many conservatives I've seen comments from over the weekend thanking me for doing this, just because, again, an attack on law enforcement is still seen as attack on law enforcement. And this president appears to think he's above the law.
Have you heard back from Andrew McCabe yet?
You know, I'll tell you, amazingly, I know you're going to be surprised, but it's hard to get high-up FBI folks' phone numbers. Ours is very public, so we've made this public job offer We have been told that he's aware of it and considering it, and we're hoping that at some point, maybe today or tomorrow, we can actually connect, one-on-one, and I can make this offer personally.
Talking to Representative Mark Pocan about his job offer to the now-fired former deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, and the wider ongoing investigations into Russian interference in the U.S. election. And on that note, Representative Pocan, the president tweeted attacks on the Mueller probe again. His personal lawyers, said that Mueller should end the probe. The probe should be ended. What do you think about those calls from the president and his attorneys?
Well, this is so clear to people, here in the heartland and across the country, what's going on. I mean, the circle is closing in closer and closer on the president and his family and his, tight personal circle, and they're doing everything they can to try to subvert the investigation. So, we have to make sure that this is allowed to run its course. If the president did something wrong, obviously there's a price to be paid, but watching him, in some days he's a petulant man-child in how he communicates. In other days, he's a ruthless demagogue. Unfortunately, some of this is in the demagogue area. And, I really worry if he fires Mueller during this investigation. I think you'll have Republicans standing up, even though, unfortunately, we haven't seen Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell really have any courage during this process.
Your colleagues on the House Intelligence Committee, your Republican colleagues, ended their own investigation, their probe. There's a similar one still going on in the Senate, and of course the Mueller probe itself. Do you think that if push came to shove, your Republican colleagues in the House would stand up to the president if he fired the special counsel?
Privately, Republicans will tell you things different than what you see from their leadership. Their leadership still are complicit with allowing him to be Donald Trump, and I think that's why last week Connor Lamb won in Pennsylvania, why special elections across the country for legislative seats have flipped seats from Republican to Democrat. But rank-and-file Republicans, when you talk to them, know the difference between right and wrong, and I think if something like this happens, I think there is a real opportunity to make sure that we're protecting the probe and, more importantly, protecting the people involved.
There has been talk and there have been efforts to pass legislation that would protect the probe preemptively, not waiting to react until after a possible firing. Are you participating in any of that kind of legislation?
Yeah, in fact, there's some talk that could be a part of the omnibus that we're putting forward. I'm not sure if Republican leadership ultimately will agree to that. We refer to it as things go up to the front office, which means people like Paul Ryan would have to show courage, and unfortunately he hasn't been very forthright in showing any courage for the last year plus. So I'm not sure if we'll get it done there, but that would be a good place because that's a must-pass bill, and it's something that I think, again, members privately all agree on. But, really I've been tremendously disappointed in how Paul Ryan has governed during this time, been very complicit with almost everything the president does. He's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. We're a co-equal branch of government. We're the check and the balance in the system. And if we just pretend like we're on the staff of the White House, we're not doing our jobs properly. And I think Paul's really been remiss.
Some of your Democratic colleagues have already, over the last bunch of months, introduced articles of impeachment. So they haven't really gone anywhere. Have you signed on to any of those? Or are you considering it?
I think I voted on one that came before the floor, but honestly, I'm a pragmatist. I can do math. We're not in charge right now of the House or the Senate, and I don't see those measures instantly taking place. So I've been trying to help make sure that, this investigation continues its course, that all the things legally and properly are able to happen so that if in case we do indeed have to do something like impeachment, it happens with the support of enough votes that we need to actually get it done. So right now, I think some of the calls have been premature in that just the votes aren't there to do it.
Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That was Wisconsin Congressional Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from the Madison area, talking about his job offer for fired FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. At least one other Democratic member of Congress is thinking about hiring McCabe. Seth Moulton of Massachusetts tweeted on Saturday that he would be happy to consider bringing him on. Right now, it's Women's History Month, and we've been reading and hearing a lot about amazing real women who have made a difference in the world, and that got us thinking about fictional characters, too. We want to hear from you right now at 800-642-1061. one, two, three, four. Are there fictional female characters that really stick with you, or one character in particular? What makes a great heroine in print in particular for you? Is there a particular author who you feel really excels at writing great female characters? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A bunch of people have already posted over on the Facebook page. Sarah there says, Lessa of Pern, and that's a character in the Dragon Riders of Pern, the science fiction series by Anne McCaffrey, mainly written by Anne McCaffrey. There have been other people picking that up. And James on Facebook loves Honor Harrington, the heroine of David Weber's Honorverse series of military science fiction books set between 4003 and 4025 AD. I admit I have, I think, the first book in that series. It's been sitting on my shelf at home for, I'm going to say, literally years now, and I've got to thank you for that suggestion. I've got to actually take it off the shelf, James, and give it a read. We also asked around here at WPR. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson is a fan of all the women characters written by Alexander McCall Smith, especially Precious Ramatswe, the main character in the number one ladies detective agency series. Judith likes her desire to help those around her. Here's a listen to the TV series based on the books.
Napotogone suggested that I talk to you. She says that you are a lady detective.
Emma, that is true. Are you in need of some detecting?
Tell me, if someone is very frightened and they live in fear of their life all day and all night, could you find out why?
Who is this frightened person?
It is my father. His name is Relisind. He owns the curio shop at African Mall.
I know it. I bought things from there.
He's an honest man. And all his life he has been a happy man too. But now he cannot even sleep. He can hardly talk. And when I ask him what's the problem, he says there are things I must not know, or I'll get into danger.
Danger? Did he use that word?
That very word.
So you want me to find out what is troubling your father?
But I do not have enough.
Don't worry about money. I will do what I can.
From the number one ladies detective agency TV version of the books by Alexander McCall Smith there, we are now asking for your favorite female characters, mainly from fiction, but you can maybe spread out into movies and TV if you want. We'll go to your calls right now. Karen is with us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi.
Who'd you want to tell us about, Karen?
I wanted to talk about Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice, written by Jane Austen hundreds of years ago.
And what do you like about that particular character, Elizabeth Bennet?
Well, she just stood up for herself against the mores of society. And as you know, back then, they were very strict on women. And so she's always been my heroine.
Karen, thank you. So is that a book you go back to again and again over time?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
That's great.
I love it.
Thank you so much for getting us started, Karen, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Michael on the line in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What character do you want to share with us, Michael?
Well, when I was a kid, you know, well, I still read a lot of books, but I read a ton of books when I was a kid, and I really especially loved fantasy books. And there was one particular librarian at the Appleton Public Library who is my go-to resource for recommendations, and she turned me on to an author named Tamora Pierce, and I read a ton of books by her, but one series in particular that I really loved was the Alana series, A-L-A-N-N-A, and it was all about this young girl in a medieval setting kind of thing where she wanted to be a knight. So she actually disguised herself as a boy for years and was a page and then a squire. And the series of books goes through the whole thing.
Wow.
And she bound herself and all this. And eventually it came out and it was revealed that she was a girl. But by that point, she had proven herself to an extent that, you know, she was largely accepted. And that's one series. I mean, I love the author, and there are other series of books that she wrote that I read, but that one in particular, I think that was the first one. And I almost positive that's the author, but, positive it's the Alana series.
The Alana series. Michael, thank you so much. That sounds like a great series, one that stuck with you, obviously. We are looking for your recommendations of great female characters in fiction in particular. You can segue into movies and TV if you want. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Share a great female character and an author who creates good ones. Jill Nadeau, Larry Mueller's producer, says there are so many, but the go-to is Nancy Drew. Smart, independent, a good friend, excellent taste in cars and clothes, brave and moral, and always a lady, Jill says. And Ned was nice to have around, but she didn't need him. Thank you so much, Jill, for sharing that one. And we heard from Guy in Milwaukee, who likes Elizabeth Salinger, on a very different note, from the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series of books. We'll go to Michael on the line now in Nelsonville. Michael, hi.
Hello. Just another quick vote for Honor Harrington.
I got to read these books. What do you like about her as a character, Michael?
Four or five of those. She starts life a little lower down the food chain, makes her way up, has a lot of problems on Basilisk Station. Wonderful book. And Weber just really can create a whole world that I enjoy as much as Star Wars or Star Trek.
Michael, thank you so much. Two votes for David Weber's Honor Harrington. I'm a science fiction guy myself. I don't know why I haven't read those. One that sticks with me, N.K. Jemisin, the main characters, I'll put that in quotes kind of. It's complicated, but the characters from the book The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin really stick with you, and some twists as to their identity as you read through the book, staying in the kind of the science fiction fantasy vein. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Casey is with us in Appleton. Casey, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share with us, Casey?
Yeah, so I was just listening to the guy talk about the Alana series. That's just basically the same as a kid's movie, Mulan. She's a warrior that pretended to be a man so she could be accepted and basically found herself through that. And I just thought that was interesting that there's a book series on it, but it's the exact same thing as Mulan.
Oh, interesting. And do you like Mulan as a character, Casey?
Oh, I loved it. I watched it ever since I was a little kid, and then I still watch it. So.
Okay. And you, so that's even as a grown-up, that movie works for you?
Yeah, I love it.
Casey, thank you so much. We are taking your calls with your favorite female characters from literature, fiction, and movies and TV if you want at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our colleague Susanna says, I've always been drawn to heroines on the naughty side. The real hero of my heart is Anne Shirley. I've read a lot of L.M. Montgomery's other work over the years, and while she often writes about literary or independent women, she can still get a little breathless and starry-eyed. Still, I keep coming back to Anne. Susanna writes, Anne shows readers it's possibly wanted and loved, even when you're not perfect, no matter how hard you try. I needed to know that, and I still do. Back to your calls now. Peter is on the line in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Peter?
Oh, actually, it's a series of books from Sherry Priest. She writes a series of books called The Clockwork Century. It's a steampunk series with very strong female characters that you kind of just fall in love with.
And it's a steampunk series, you said?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of fun and a good. And is this the main character of the book?
Yeah, the main character is like in one of the books, Bone Shaker. She has a female character that actually is from the Civil War and is like the head of the nursing unit.
That sounds great, Peter. Thanks a lot for that suggestion. Carrie is with us next in Holman. Carrie, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about Carrie?
I just wanted to put a little vote for Amy Tan. She wrote the Joy Luck Club, and I just loved her explanation of the way that mothers shape their daughters' lives.
And is there a favorite character of yours in the book?
I can't remember if it's Mai Xing or Xing Mai, but she's the daughter who learns more and more about her mother as the story unfolds.
Fantastic.
And becomes less critical of her mom as she learns more about her and her background.
Fantastic, Carrie. Thanks for sharing that. We'll go next to Doug in Lancaster. Doug, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I can't believe there hasn't been a shout-out for Hermione Granger yet.
Well, there is now. Make the case, Doug, Hermione.
Without her, Harry Potter never would have made it to the end of the books.
Doug, I don't know if you've seen this. Somebody wrote, there are a few people have written over the years that Hermione Granger's name should be on the title. It should be her books, not Harry Potter's books. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree with that.
Doug, thank you so much for sharing that. Time for, another call or two. Maureen is with us in Bailey's Harbor. Maureen, hi.
Hi. I'm really enjoying your program right now, and I'm so excited to get to reading more of the great heroines that people are recommending to read about. My favorite is Ayla. She's the main character in Jean Auld's series, but the first book is Clan of the Cape Bear.
I haven't read those. Those are good?
It's an amazing body of work that Jean Auld did with other researchers. But the strength that I find in Ayla is this is a young woman who is born into a trauma very early in life. And she is taken by people who are very, very different.
All right, Maureen, I got to jump in because we're just about out of time. We've also had more recommendations. Our colleague Katie, I mentioned Tamora Pierce, which I think is what one of our callers was thinking of earlier. Let's see, Phyllis Bornin, is that what it says, is a recommendation from a caller. Andy Moore weighs in with Marge Simpson, and Marta from the Educational Communications Board recommends Gerald Brooks as an author. Hey, you can keep sharing your favorite female characters and authors who create them over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, a new report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel finds that Russian efforts to inflame racial tensions included the Milwaukee area after the Sherman Park riots in the city 2 years ago. Now there are bipartisan calls for a federal investigation. We talked to one of the reporters who uncovered that story. First, throughout the United States, between 40 and 50 million people carry some amount of student loan debt. Nationwide, that comes to more than $1.4 trillion. This growing debt has had some experts worried for a while. Some worried that there's a looming loan default crisis on the horizon. Others argue that our economy might be slowed down as people spend more money on debt than on goods and services. Our next guest co-wrote a new study that outlines a unique way to deal with all the student loan debt in the country, have the government cancel all federal loan debt and pay off private loans, reducing that $1.4 trillion in debt to zero. Stephanie Kelton is a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Why did you and your colleagues want to tackle this issue of student loan debt?
Well, we actually had somebody approach us and ask us if we would be willing to look at this issue and do an economic analysis. It was a couple who themselves had gone to UC Berkeley, California, back in the day, many, many years ago when it was basically tuition-free, and they have a daughter, and the daughter has a friend who is struggling with student loan debt. And they got interested in this question, and when they started to dig around, they realized what a substantial problem this is for millions and millions of Americans. And they funded a study and asked us to just take a look and ask the question, what would happen if somehow we were able to just erase it all?
And that somehow is in some ways a key word there. $1.4 plus trillion dollars now, that is a large amount of money. Is that something that you think could realistically happen?
Well, there's nothing to prevent it from happening but the will of policymakers who could take this up and decide to pass legislation to enact something like this. So, everything is politically possible, as they say. I don't know whether it's realistic. You use the word realistic. It's certainly politically possible.
And in talking about this, I've seen at least some of your colleagues compare the amount of money in that in this idea of forgiving all student loan debt to the amounts of money involved in the recent tax overhaul plan.
Yeah, that was sort of inevitable, right? Because our study came out kind of shortly on the heels of the recent tax cuts, and the number that was most widely cited with the Republican tax cuts that passed was $1.5 trillion. This is the estimate that the Congressional Budget Office put on the Republican legislation, saying that would add about $1.5 trillion to deficits over the next 10 years. So a lot of people saw that $1.5 trillion number and the $1.4 trillion number in our study, and then did the inevitable, which is to compare the cost, essentially, of the two, and then begin asking questions like which one would have actually done more to boost economic growth, job creation, to deliver on the same sorts of promises that the tax legislation is supposed to deliver on.
Well, let's get into that question. In your report, what kind of findings do you have? What kind of impact would total student loan debt forgiveness, you think, have on the economy?
So we ran a number of simulations, and we used a couple of different widely respected macro models just to make sure that the results were robust. You get a range of estimates. But, you know, what you're looking at, I think, is not really terribly surprising if you relieve people who are currently, on average, making payments around $350 a month to service their student loan debt. The question becomes, what if that payment went away and all of these people could then do something else with that money? So what we found is that you get a boost to real economic activity, that is real GDP, or what economists just kind of call the economy, improves. You would add something like $86 to $108 billion a year in real GDP over the 10-year period. So, you know, cumulatively something like $860 to just over $1 trillion in additional real GDP over and above what we would have if we didn't do the debt cancellation. What's interesting is that you're able to do something like this without creating an inflation problem, without causing interest rates to spike. So you get job creation, you get real GDP growth, you get a boost to the private sector. State and local governments enjoy a benefit. Their budget positions improve as a result of this. So there are lots of good things that happen as a result of our model simulations, and nothing bad happens is the kind of simple way to put this.
Stephanie Kelton is with us, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University, talking about a report she co-authored looking at the idea of canceling all student loan debt, forgiving federal loan debt, and having the federal government buy private student loan debt. Stephanie, we heard along the lines of what you were just talking about. Kelsey on Facebook tells us if she didn't have to worry about student debt, she'd be able to save for a house within a year and could buy a new car for her husband. Is that the kind of thing we're thinking about here, especially maybe for younger people with student loan debt, 20s, 30s? We've heard arguments that, hey, because they're paying student loan debt, they're not doing things like Kelsey is talking about, buying that house, buying that car.
Yeah, Kelsey's exactly hit the nail on the head. And in fact, there's lots of research to substantiate the kinds of things that she's dealing with at the micro level for the macro, the economy as a whole. Federal Reserve banks across the U.S. and other researchers, academics have looked at this. And, you know, there's pretty broad agreement that this level of student debt, which, by the way, is now far surpassed the amount of credit card debt that we have in this country. So we're talking about a very, very large amount of debt that has to be serviced by 44 million or so people every single month. And, yeah, the research suggests that this is holding back spending on a variety of other things, everything from, you know, people deciding to start their own business, buy a home, get married, start a family, buy a new car, all of those sorts of things. And so one thing I would add is that our study is we think the findings are quite conservative in the sense that it doesn't take into account all of the secondary and tertiary benefits of the kind that Kelsey's talking about. So, you know, it would be an even bigger boon for the economy if we were able somehow to model all of those extra spending effects that she's talking about.
We also heard from John on Facebook, who says students with debt knew what they were getting into, and he doesn't expect anyone to pay off his mortgage so he can buy other things. And that's got to be a big issue for people, a fairness issue. There's somebody who says, hey, I went to maybe not my top choice of school. I went to something more affordable. Why, you know, should somebody who made a different decision be rewarded? Or maybe somebody who didn't go to school at all might say, well, I didn't go to school because I couldn't afford it, and now you're telling me you're paying this off for someone else. Is there a basic fairness issue there?
Yeah, you know, I understand that, and of course we've heard that quite a bit after the study was released. Look, I would say to people like him that there is something unfair about what's happened. But I would point out that part of what's unfair is that, you know, my parents were able to go to college at a time when it was basically free to do so. And we're now moving into an era where we're beginning to make public colleges and universities tuition free once again. You're seeing this early on. We began in Tennessee, but now New York and California are moving in this direction. And I think the momentum is there to continue to see states move, you know, to make their public colleges and universities tuition free, or very nearly so, maybe with an income threshold like they've done in New York. So what's unfair, it seems to me, is that, you know, segment of the population that got trapped by history. They weren't born early enough to benefit from an era in which it was free to go to college, or basically free, and they weren't born late enough to enter into the era where we're going in that direction again. And so, you know, we could get into the granular fights about which college somebody chose or didn't choose, and to be sure, you know, you're not gonna satisfy everyone in terms of, you know, the perception about what's fair. But I would suggest that there's something fundamentally unfair about trapping a generation or more of people in history in this student debt trap.
Would student loan forgiveness in a way be regressive? Wealthier people might have been able to go to that more expensive college. They'll have higher student loan debt that they might be better able to pay off in the long run. This would benefit the top part of the economy potentially more than others.
Yeah, but by saying that the people who are at the top have an easier time paying it off, what this cancellation would actually do is help those who most struggle to pay off their student loan debts. And part of what's unfair, I think, is, you know, the narrative that we have sold. And I'm an academic, so I'm part of the community of people who have sold this narrative to students. Look, you graduate high school, what are you supposed to do? There's sort of a compact in place, at least, you know, rhetorically. You get out of high school, you go to college. You play by all the rules, you work hard, you make your way through college, you pay your way through, it's an investment. We tell people it's an investment in your future. You're supposed to do this. And then they graduate with student loan debt that, you know, for many of them is just too much. They can't survive with the amount of student loan debt. They end up back at home living with mom and dad. And you know, so there's this problem with this idea that the path to a better future, to the middle class, necessarily runs through higher ed. Meanwhile, states have disinvested. We've shifted more and more of the burden of funding what is essentially a public good, and we've forgotten that, and we treat it like a private good. We shift more and more of the burden of paying for college onto the individual, as if there aren't broader societal benefits to be had by having people go through college, and then we expect students to somehow graduate into an economy that's been weak, that hasn't delivered on the promise of that good job at the end of the day with a good salary that allows them to work their way out of debt. So there are just all kinds of, I think, problems with, you know, the idea that somehow people didn't do the right thing, and now it would be wrong to try to alleviate the burden.
Talking to Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She recently co-authored a study looking at how to address the student loan crisis in the United States, looking at the idea of canceling student loan debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of the federal government forgiving federal student loan debt, buying up private student loan debt? If this is you, how is student loan debt affecting your life? Do you think this is a good idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about student loan debt with Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University, and she's the co-author of a new study looking at the idea of erasing student loan debt, all of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? What questions do you have for our guest, and How has student loan debt affected your life? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Hi, guys. I was my question is, I kind of have a comment. We tend to think of debt as being a generational problem associated mainly with millennials, but I myself know people 40 and over who have plenty of student loan debt. And my question is, what kind of impact will we have on things like retirement and savings in the society in general? Retirement and savings, what kind of broad impact would it have on the society as a whole? And I'll just hang up and listen to the answer.
John, thanks for the call. So, Stephanie, for older people who have student loan debt.
Yeah, he's exactly right. There are, you know, if you look at the age demographic, most of the student loan debt is concentrated among younger people, 40 and under, for sure. But there are certainly people, many of them, you know, are carrying their own student loan debt for loans that they took out to go to school themselves. But a number of people have co-signed loans for nieces and nephews for their kids and so forth. And so some of that is reflected there as well. You've got people on Social Security having their Social Security garnished in order to pay student loan debt. I mean, so John raises an important issue for sure. The question about, you know, what are the implications of canceling student loan debt for people in those age demographics? You know, obviously, if you've got a payment that you sit down and make every single month, you take out your checkbook and you write a check to pay back a portion of your student loan debt, you don't have to do that anymore, then you can take out that checkbook and do something else. Or, as John suggested, you can begin to save a little bit. And so we've got a population today, you know, here in this country, virtually half of the population has no meaningful savings whatsoever. So young people are starting out with so much debt, they're not able to begin to save anything, to set anything aside. So in addition to the boost in spending that we look at in this report, you also get an increase in the ability to save for the future. And so there are benefits that run exactly along the lines he's describing.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Angela with us in Madison. Angela, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I feel that it should be forgiven, especially for people in my circumstances. I was in college, public college, and I didn't even get to finish my degree. Unfortunately, I got very, very sick and ended up being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So at the end of the month, you have $20,000 monthly going towards your multiple sclerosis medicine that I take, or you have to make your monthly payment to your student loan. Now, I do have insurance, so I do have to pay just a small portion of the medicine, but sitting down with your checkbook, you're like, do I pay my medicine or my student loan this month?
Angela, thanks. I want to bring Stephanie in. Is that something you looked at, student loan debt conflicting with healthcare costs?
Yeah, well, we didn't in this report, but for sure, it's exactly the kind of thing that Angela's describing, that for many, many Americans, it is a choice just that stark. Do I make, you know, what do I do with this limited amount of money that I have at my disposal every month? And so freeing up some additional disposable income for people like Angela would have a very meaningful impact on her life. I know that for sure.
Thanks for that call, Angela. Talking to Stephanie Kelton from Stony Brook University about a report she co-authored on the idea of erasing, canceling student loan debt. Back to your calls. Susan is with us in New Berlin. Susan, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if Steffi could explain just when it was that college was basically free. I went in the 70s, and my older brothers and sisters went in the late 60s. And it certainly wasn't free for us. We did get a couple of scholarships, but that was because of hard work in our high school years. And then we all worked our way through college. And my kids now went to school in the 2000s and early 2010s, and they did the same thing. They worked their way all the way through worked all the way through college and had loans and worked their butts off and got those paid off.
Susan, thanks for the call. Stephanie, first of all, you did suggest that college had been basically free in the past. Do you want to put that in a little context for Susan?
Sure. I mean, you know, when I went to college, I went to a large state school, and tuition for me was a little over $400 a semester, so extremely inexpensive. Now, that was in the, you know, early and mid-1990s. But if you look at what's happened to the cost of tuition at public colleges and universities since 1980 to where we are today, costs have increased 350%. Now, wages and salaries have not, by any stretch of the imagination, kept up. So when you look back, you know, 30 years, it was possible for someone to work in the summer in a minimum wage job and make enough money just working a summer job that paid minimum wage to pay for their education. So they could go to school the rest of the year, not have to work, and they'd make enough money. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about, you know, college being so affordable that we have moved so far from anything that resembles that. You could work at a minimum wage job all year today and barely be able to afford the cost of tuition, and then you're trying to work and go to school at the same time.
Thanks for the call, Susan. Time for one more call. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I have to agree a little bit with the last caller. I have two children. They're 23 and 26, and they both have gone to college for 4 years and got their degrees. They both are still paying off student loans. They don't like it. It's not enjoyable, but they both worked all summer long. Every year they went to college, they worked two minimum wage jobs. They also worked all through high school. I've also seen a lot of their friends not have any jobs at all and have a lot of time for fun, and then they cry because they have student loans. I mean, I paid my way through school, too. I know it's not easy, but I do think that some kids need to step up a little bit more and take on more responsibility.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Stephanie, kids need to step up.
Yeah, well, look, as I've mentioned, what we've done in the course of the last three decades especially is to shift so much of the burden of paying for college onto the student as states have disinvested, as tuition costs have escalated and so forth, that, you know, what was once possible for many, many people is just increasingly out of reach. And this isn't to say that there aren't students who did as, you know, as Lisa and Angela described or Susan described, it isn't to say that there aren't students who are able to make it. What this study does is to say, look, there are 44 million people in this country. We've got closing on $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. It's a hypothetical. It's not a policy proposal per se. It's a hypothetical. What would happen if it went away? Would there be broad benefits to the economy? So it's not to uniquely benefit people who didn't play by the rules, who weren't able to find a good job. You know, those are the lucky people. They graduated into an economy that wasn't crashing. They didn't graduate in 2008, 2009, 2010, in the depths of the Great Depression, or Great Recession, and as we were coming out of that. These people maybe graduated a little bit later in a stronger job market. They were able to find work that paid a decent salary. They're doing okay. All right, there are those people for sure. But what this study does is say, if we were to cancel all the outstanding loan debt, would it benefit all of us in the sense that we get a stronger, more prosperous economy for all of us to work in, for all of us to invest in, for all of us to prosper in?
And very briefly, Stephanie, are you hoping, whether it's this idea or something else, that there's more, I guess, bold thinking on student loan debt?
Yeah, I am, because, you know, I spent some time in D.C. I know that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have been concerned about this issue, and there have been bites at the apple taken, a number of different proposals. I think at the moment we're going in a direction that disappoints me with the Secretary of Education currently looking to make it harder for students to work their way to get loan forgiveness and to, you know, get some help dealing with the student loan debt problem. But I think that, you know, I'm optimistic that at some point we're going to turn attention back to this, and some of these bolder proposers are going to be on the agenda.
Thanks to our guest, Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University, with us to talk about student loan debt in the United States.
Ooh, I'm a rebel just for kicks, I've been feeling it since 1966.
Even if you don't follow pop music too closely, there's a good chance you've heard this song. It's Feel It Still by the band Portugal the Man. The song was a big hit when it came out last year. It's been featured in movie ads for Apple, Vitamin Water, and the movie Peter Rabbit. I'll admit I've liked pretty much everything I've heard by Portugal the Man so far. But that's all old news. What's new is Weird Al Yankovic. This weekend, he released his remix of Feel It Still. Now, this isn't your standard Weird Al parody where he makes up new zany lyrics and covers the song in his own way. This is a more subtle take on this song. Weird Al keeps the original vocals, then subtly weaves in a musical background drawn from his and my ethnic heritage. Hey, give it a listen. See if you can spot how he's changed it here. So here on Central Time, it's Weird Al Yankovic and his remix of Feel It Still.
I can keep my hands on myself.